with the Ghost of Radio. Welcome to episode 3 of This Hour podcast. And because it is episode 3, you know what we're here for. Hopefully the enjoyment and definitely the critique of mid-century horror radio. And you also know the drill. I'm about to reach into the cauldron, as it were, and pull out an episode at random for our review. So I'm in there. It's happening. What is it going to be? Oh, this is filed under Best Shows. We will be listening to They Met at Dorset from Lights Out. What a tremendous episode from a fantastic series. They Met at Dorset. Go to Lights Out online. It's available in many places. Find this episode, listen to it, enjoy the hell out of it, and then come back to me at the Ghost Radio. You will already be happy from having listened to it. But our discussion, I hope, will make us all even happier. So go and listen. We'll be back in a moment. See you soon. All right, we're back. And you've just listened to They Met at Dorset, so you are feeling okay. I obviously love this episode, and I love Lights Out, but I want to give a little background, just a little groundwork before we get into it, with things to know about the series Lights Out, everybody. I think there are 4 points. First, this was a show with big ambitions. Every episode was designed to horrify or to create a very imaginative, fascinating, otherworld scenario in which moral issues could play out. But we'll come back to the moral issues in a moment. So it was very ambitious, but not every episode was great. You can go to Lights Out online and find crappy episodes with sexism and mostly racism fails. And sometimes its attempts at innovation were just tedious. There's an episode called Man in the Middle that would be great if it was 15 minutes long, but it's twice that long and it just gets unbearable, the gimmick that it had. But when Lights Out innovated in horror, it was amazing. And it had 2 specific kinds of horror, one that I call sheer fantasy horror, and one that I call, wartime realism horror. Lights Out was started in 1934. It was created by Willis Cooper, who would go on to create the other fantastic show, Quiet Please. It ran from 34 to 36 with Willis Cooper, and then Arch Obler took it over in June of 1936, and he reran a lot of the Willis Cooper scripts. The show was very popular with Cooper, and Obler was just kind of keeping it going from 36 to 38, because in the summer of 1938, the network said it was canceling Lights Out, which it did in 1939, so Obler took off. He did a lot of other things. He wrote for the movies, he wrote for other radio shows, but in 1942, he was out of work, and so Obler revived the program in prime time, not late night radio, but primetime radio, with Ironized Yeast as its sponsor, and we've talked about them in the first episode of the podcast. This run from October of 1942 to September of 1943, for me, are the prime Lights Out years. And that is because World War II is the spirit that haunts these years of Lights Out. I think I haven't heard another radio show. I haven't heard them all, but I haven't heard another horror radio show that openly addresses the war, that talks about it in the breaks, that has it as the focus of its live episodes. Lights Out is the only one. Obler had always said that for every 2 horror episodes he wrote, sheer fantasy horror, he would try to write a more dramatic horror story about morality, covering moral and social and political issues. And during World War II, those were ready-made. Obler was passionate about the Allied war effort. And while this sometimes provoked some revolting stereotypical Japanese characters who were referred to with a slur, his focus was really almost always not on hating the Axis as individuals or types of people, but on loving liberty and justice for all and the American way. He wrote a separate wartime propaganda series called Plays for Americans, and his focus was on good in the form of justice overcoming evil. And justice could be supernatural retribution, or it could be very down to earth, and on Lights Out, it was supernatural retribution. So let's talk about these two kinds of horror that Lights Out had. First, it had the sheer fantasy horror, and the key to its success is that the horror is inevitable. That may sound counterintuitive, it may not sound exciting or scary or surprising, but it is all those things. Horror that fails dances around the demands of its plot. You know, and Lights Out does not do that. It's like a kind of theater called Grand Guignol. It's brutal, it's literal, it's bloody, and very important, it's relentless. Once the mechanism of doom has targeted you, there is no escape. Maybe there's no reason why you have been chosen or targeted. You may or may not deserve doom, but it doesn't matter. Characters may repeatedly protest or wildly ask why they have been chosen or singled out. It doesn't matter why. What matters is that you have been chosen, and once you have been chosen, the mechanism of doom starts, and it will continue to run until you are destroyed. Many great Lights Out episodes focus on this, and many of them devote many minutes to a detailed narration by the person targeted of the horrible, slow process of their actual death. There's no music. There's often no sound effects. It's just you listening to someone being destroyed and hearing them describe each horrible step in the process until their voice stops. For me, this works better than horror that is character-based, that invests in its characters, because if you are invested in the characters as people, that makes it sadistic. If I'm given a backstory and I'm supposed to choose characters who I like, as most horror movies ask you to do, then inevitably that means I'm supposed to enjoy watching them die terribly. Oh, I really like Janet, and now she's being killed in a tanning bed. I'm supposed to enjoy watching the insane killer cat and mouse them over and over. I'm supposed to enjoy seeing people I like tortured, and I become part of the problem. And we all know this with the horror movies. Well, it's okay if the black guy dies, or the slut, or the other girl, or the other girl, just as long as my favorites, the hot white couple, live. This way we are drawn into the fail of ourselves choosing people to torture. In good horror radio, we don't make that choice. We don't even know all the time what made that choice. Some inexorable fate in the universe made the choice, and the characters are not well developed. You hardly get to know most of them before the process begins. You have no investment in them. You don't like or dislike them. They're just pawns introduced so the horror machine can grind them up. They're usually very stock types. The secretary, a criminal, a scientist. I'm not invested in them, but in what they represent. They are either stand-ins for humanity in general or people who have chosen to do evil. And therefore, my enjoyment comes from watching or listening in horrid fascination as they are inevitably overtaken by blind fate. And I'm watching the machine of fate more than I'm watching the people. I'm enjoying a glimpse into the unfathomable workings of the universe as they are acted out on unsuspecting people who are simply representatives of the human race. I'm allowed to observe this kind of fate from the outside, and that way I can think about it and maybe learn from it. So that's what Lights Out does well. It has the courage, in its best episodes, to set up a cold, immovable, immortal doom machine and let it destroy people. It passes the Agatha Christie test. It really lets people get what you think is coming to them, no matter how horrible it is. Now that's the sheer fantasy horror.
the wartime realism horror that Arch Obler pioneered in the 1942-1943 World War II era of the show is again about that kind of inevitability. Good will destroy evil. No matter how strong evil seems in the form of the Axis, good is going to destroy them. And we have to remember that in 1942 and 43, these were the darkest years of the war for the Allies. It did not look inevitable that the Allies were going to win the war. I mean, in 1942, Axis powers covered, you know, a good deal of the planet. So this was not Obler, you know, taking a free ride on something that seemed pretty obvious. He was willing the Allies to destroy evil through these shows. And unlike so many later movies and books, characters from the Axis, who are almost always German, are not given a backstory. There is no chance that they are human. Unlike the characters in fantasy horror who are inexplicably chosen for doom, these people have inexplicably chosen evil, and so they have chosen doom for themselves, and Obler never gives quarter. There's no chance that you're going to sympathize with them. They chose evil, and it wasn't by accident. They're not really sorry for it, and they're not doing it against their will. During World War II, evil is a choice, and it's an identity, and it's your entire identity, and you will not be spared once justice targets you for destruction. So in these wartime realism episodes, horror is fantastical. It can be supernatural, but it brings justice. And so it's okay to stare once it starts rolling. You're witnessing it so that you never forget that justice will come, even to the most apparently invincible villain. And it's right to witness that as it plays out. So it's always a shame when a Lights Out episode from this period has been trimmed of its intros and breaks and its full outro by the people who put it online. A lot of people, you know, when they put on old radio shows, they take out the ads and a lot of the break chatter because they think people just want to hear the story, and that it ruins my appreciation of the CBS Radio Mystery Theater to hear an ad for Sears. I love those things because it really puts you back in the whole milieu that the show first appeared in. But for Lights Out, it's especially crucial that you hear all of the wartime messages that Obler inserted and talked about with Frank Martin, the Ironized Yeast sponsor spokesman. This episode, where I found it, starts, you know, without hardly any intro. This is down to business. Okay, you can tell from Obler's extremely short speech introducing the episode that it's about the war that is in progress in February 1943 when this ran, and so we go straight to the action. So let's go.
Lights out, everybody. Stories of the supernatural and the supernormal, dramatizing the fantasies and the mysteries of the unknown. We tell you this frankly, so if you wish to avoid the excitement and tension of these imaginative plays, we urge you calmly but sincerely to turn off your radio now.
This is Arch Obler. Tonight we tell you a story about two gentlemen of the German army, the Nazi army. The scene is a bombing plane flying over England.
You are ready? Perfect, Herr Hauptmann. No, speak English now. We are almost there. And remember, from the moment your feet touch that blasted English soil, only English.
Yes, Captain.
Now, take your equipment. Parachute, rucksack, gun.
All in order, sir.
We should be there in a few moments. Now, remember, if for any reason I do not get to our point of rendezvous, or if I'm not there when you get there, you are to wait 2 hours, and then go on alone to Melbourne and carry out our orders. Understood?
Yes, Captain. Sit off.
Your Herr Hoffman.
This is I?
What is it, Herr?
How's the woman ready for
Lawson? This is Herr Hoffman.
Okay, we've met our main two characters, a Nazi captain and his lieutenant, the lieutenant and the captain. And they are sneaking into England. They're on a mission that has not been explained yet. And they are going to an abandoned country house, English country house, that they are supposed to rendezvous with their spy contact at. So they do a little traveling, and then they finally get to the house and they meet the people there.
Captain.
What?
So sorry, sir.
You heard what?
Lost.
Infernal flashlight. Give me yours.
Yes, Captain.
Now, walk on. The house is empty for years. You should know by now that our military intelligence makes no mistakes.
Yes, Captain.
Captain, I heard. And the orders, Thomas.
Yes, yes, one.
Good evening, gentlemen. Won't you come in by the fire?
Yes, thank you. Come, Thomas.
My name is Burley.
I am Edward Cooper. My friend Thomas Davies and I got lost in the rain. We thought this house was quite deserted.
Deserted? Not for 500 years. Well, may I present Lady Burley?
How do you do?
How do you do?
My great aunt, Mrs. Westman.
How do you do?
Now, William, they can beat the rest of the family later. Does someone give them a drink? They're soaked to the skin.
Oh, had to brutally cut them off there just a little bit. There's a lot of rapid-fire talking in this episode. Just this little short intro to the English people they meet at the supposedly deserted country house is loaded with meaning. The hospitality they show to these strangers represents the goodness of the English who are fighting the Nazis. They're warm, they're gracious and friendly, they're a big family, all happy together, they're capable of the noble emotion of generosity, all the things that the German soldiers have been established as being incapable of. The German soldiers are only motivated by reward and hatred. They murder because it will get them a reward. They are Nazis. But we have a little hint of what's coming when they say to Lord Burley, "We thought this place was deserted." And Lord Burley says, "Deserted? Not for 500 years. Like, there is a long history of English goodness and strength that the Nazis have no idea about. They don't know what they're up against. 500 years of this kind of English goodness pitted against just a few years of Nazi evil. I think we know how this is going to go.
Our inquisitiveness, Mr. Cooper, but after all, Milford Towers is quite deserted, you know.
Yes, we know.
What do you mean?
Mr. Davies here and I started quite early. Lost ourselves completely. It got dark and here we are.
Oh, yes. John.
Yes, Sir William.
Ring up the constable.
Yes, yes, of course.
Wait a minute. Why the constable?
Well, it's quite obvious.
Is it?
Of course. Ring up the constable, John.
No, put up your hands. All of you.
I say now.
Oh, what is he going to do with the gun? What is he going to do with the gun?
Take that old woman, keep quiet.
Old woman.
Lieutenant kind of chance, David. There mustn't be chosen. I said to keep your hands up.
German, William. German spies.
Not spies, old woman. German soldiers.
You're in civilian clothing.
German soldiers, Englishman. Soldiers. Soldiers to rescue a soldier.
William, what are they talking about?
How long did you think we would permit you to keep our great Rudolf Hess in prison?
Malhoff, Rudolf Hess? What are you? Shut your mouth.
How dare you?
You two are no hero. Now, quiet, all of you. Nimm den nächsten Zimmer und schweig sie.
Alle?
Alle, quickly.
Go.
All of you. Do as he says. What do you want me to shoot?
The next room, quickly.
Okay, so their charade falls through and they were revealed to be Germans, just the way the woman says Germans. It sums it all up. And again, this is because these are not human beings anymore. They have chosen evil, and now they are just Germans, or as the captain insists, Nazis. And he says, she says, you're German spies. And Lord Burleigh says, but you're in civilian clothing. And the captain says triumphantly, German soldiers. Just another example of how the Germans are underhanded and they would pose as civilians, yet carry out the actions of soldiers, which include murdering all these people. Side note is, Rudolf Hess, the Nazi leader, flew to England, or tried to fly to England, to come up with a secret peace agreement with King George VI, whom the Nazis mistakenly believed might not be fully behind Churchill in the war effort. So he flew to England, he landed in Scotland, he was captured and imprisoned on May 10th, 1941, at an old English country house called Mitchett Place, which had been turned into a kind of a garrison. So this is Obler drawing on real war events and taking the idea of the English country house and what it could stand for into a horror story. So we come back from a break. We heard the gong. Well, you didn't hear it in the clip I played, but there's a gong. We think there was a break that's been cut out. And the captain is hassling his lieutenant about not being enthusiastic enough about the mission. The captain's laying out the mission for him, and the lieutenant just keeps saying, yes, captain, yes, captain. And finally, the captain yells, doesn't this mean anything to you? But then he immediately relents and says, you're a good soldier. You believe, you obey. Asking a Nazi if a war can mean anything to him is not just pointless, it's contrary to being a Nazi. He can't feel noble emotions. There can be no meaningful action for him. He can't feel it. He doesn't need to feel it. He just has to believe the hate he's told and carry out, obey the commands to carry it out. So they are in the abandoned house, deciding to wait until morning to head out and meet their accomplice in the daylight.
It would be most satisfactory, eh, Lieutenant, to tell about this little adventure when we get home. Come right in under the noses of the British. And what are you listening to?
I don't know, sir.
There's nothing. Leave a God, man. Why do you stand there with your head twisted like an old woman waiting for
you?
Be still. In the next room.
Who?
We will find out. And you told me there was no one left.
There was no one.
Come.
Good evening, gentlemen. Won't you come in by the fire?
Hey.
All of them. My name is Burleigh. May I present Lady Burleigh?
How do you do?
Shot them. You said you shot them.
My great aunt, Mrs. Weston.
How do you do? Now, William, they can meet the rest of the family later. Someone give them a drink there. Soaked to the skin.
I did kill him.
You dirty liar.
There you are, gentlemen. Your drink.
No! You blasted England and bodied this trait.
Oh, yes, gentlemen. My son-in-law, John Pierce.
Stop talking! This time you will die!
I didn't fully address the shock that you have the first time these people are killed. They're just killed. You know, it's not a long half hour of cat and mouse of will the Nazis kill these people or will the people outwit them? No, they're immediately killed because that's what Nazis would do and that's what war does. So you're kind of recovering from that and wondering, well, what is the plot from this point forward if these people are already dead when they reappear? And immediately, they're shot again. The drama is not around wondering if these people will be shot. The drama is around recognizing the creaking sound of the machinery of doom starting to rev up. And from this point, we're going to move pretty relentlessly to our conclusion.
How soon will we go?
In the morning, in the morning. You want to get lost again in that infernal woods?
No, Captain.
What is the matter with you?
Nothing, sir.
No, I understand. Your dereliction of duty. You think I will report? No. Help me carry out our orders tomorrow. And the fact that you did not shoot those Englanders as I ordered will never reach the ears of Berlin. Anyway, they are dead now. You know that. I know that. It is ended. Okay.
It is they.
No, I shot them myself. I shot about each four.
It is they.
No, it cannot be. I'll show you. I'll show you. You see, they are dead.
Won't you come in by the fire?
Now we know for sure that the mechanism of just horror, justice working through horrible means, is moving relentlessly to a conclusion. But of course the captain won't acknowledge this. It's not part of the victory of evil over all that he mandates and lives by. He claims that when he was in Poland, part of the Nazi invasion, that the Poles he killed, afterward they seemed to reappear, but it was just a trick of the mind, just a hallucination by weak soldiers. This is an idea that Obler would revisit in a story called Execution and really play it out. But now they've killed the people for the third time, they're still stuck in the house, and they're waiting.
I'm thinking that maybe this is what I've always been afraid of. Czechoslovakia, Holland, Belgium, France. This is what I always was afraid of.
Of what?
That someday I would wait for them.
Then?
I commanded a firing squad in Slovakia. We shot women.
What's that got to do with this?
In Belgium, too. Women.
What are you talking about?
In Poland, the tank I was in was covered with the blood of the children.
You blasted fool. You are a soldier of the greater German Reich.
I think to myself, why don't I just leave you here and run?
You would not dare.
I think to myself, what is the use? Sooner or later, they will come for me.
Who will come for you?
Yeah, Hans has it right. What's the use of running away from that country house? What's the use of abandoning Captain? It doesn't matter. Sooner or later, the dead will come for him. Yes, that's correct, Hans. And we don't feel sorry for Hans. Yeah, you don't feel sorry for someone who has chosen evil and is now reaping the consequences of evil. That's the rules of horror radio. So they are waiting for dawn to come so that they can leave the house without getting lost. But Hans, the lieutenant, is now saying if they can get to the dawn without those English people reappearing, he will, as he puts it, go on believing. But if they do reappear, he's going to kill both of them, his captain and himself, with the grenade he has. If they laugh again, we were wrong, you and I, you and I and the Führer, he says. If we were wrong, I would rather finish it now, here. But we know it's not finished. Oh, we get the sense that death is only going to be the beginning for Hans and the captain. All right, day does begin to dawn.
Never.
Look. On the wall. Light. The sun.
Day.
Not quite.
I was right. And the bill, right? No one can stop us. We are the chosen. Put down the grenade, Hans, and...
Listen. Listen.
To what? To what?
I thought that I should...
Listen. Listen to them.
The dead come back to repay us for what we've done.
No. Don't pull the trigger and stop them. Wait, I'll prove it. I'll prove it. I'll show you they are dead. Someone else in there. I'll show you. Show you.
Good evening, gentlemen. Won't you come in by the fire?
You see, it is for death! You were wrong! Oh, the grenade, don't hunt!
Good morning, Rika.
Oh, good morning, Harold. Lovely morning.
Aye.
Certainly rained last night.
Less thunder.
What brings you out so early, Harold?
Oh, me old woman told told me she had an explosion or something just at daybreak, so I come over.
Explosion?
Aye.
she must have dreamt it. Birds singing in the morning. No explosion here.
Aye.
But I do wish they had teared down these old ruins. It does no good leaving them stand there to remind us that Sir William and all his family were killed by a German air bomb 3 years ago. Yes, 3 years ago last night.
Oh, Natch. Oh, yeah. Those English people were ghosts. You get the sense they have not only taken the two Germans to their eternal torture, but that they were specifically summoned up to do so, and that this may not be the last time this happens. Hans and his captain never had a chance. The Nazis don't have a chance. Justice will come to them all and to all who oppose goodness. Ooh, so in keeping with the all-business tone of this episode, the conclusion with Obler and the IY rep Frank Martin gets right down to it, talking about buying war savings stamps. During the war, you could buy books of stamps, put them into a larger book, and then turn them in to purchase war bonds, which would fund the war, and then you'd get your money back after the war. So here they are leaping right into it.
And now, what about miracles, Mr. Obler?
Well, let's consider a few. We, all of us, are living only in a series of miracles. Now, it may seem a far cry from the miracle of heroism to talking about that war stamp book of yours, but there's another little miracle. 8 25-cent stamps, 8 hand grenades. 6 25-cent stamps, 1 winter combat helmet. 30 10-cent stamps, a pair of jungle fighting boots. An anti-tank mine for 15 50-cent stamps. Commando trench knife with 40 10-cent stamps. Every empty space you fill in with your stamp album adds to the rain of steel going into the camps of the enemy. Every time you fill your album and turn it into a bomb, well, you turn it into a bomb. You turn the rain of steel into a hurricane. Your way to do more to help beat the Axis by buying enough stamps to fill the empty spaces in your stamp book, then turn it into a war bomb. It will bring on that inevitable miracle of the bomb.
It is later than you think.
I like the concept that Archibald Obler introduces at the end there of the inevitable miracle. It's a twisty kind of concept that belongs right in the wheelhouse of Lights Out. What is a little unnerving is that his audio, even worse than mine at this point, I think he's saying the inevitable miracle of the bomb. I don't think that the Manhattan Project was common knowledge in February of 1943. I'm not sure what he's referring to, but I do know that if he did know about the race to create atomic weapons, he would have been all for it. Again, there's no horror that is too extreme for those who commit evil. And it's only our hindsight of the past couple decades that tells us that sometimes in your attempts to destroy evil, you can destroy everybody. And that's the kind of machine of fate we should not get trapped in. That's it for our friends, Lights Out. For this time, anyway, sometimes you'll see this episode and others described as wartime propaganda episodes. To see it that way is to miss the whole point of the horror in Lights Out, where he wanted to bring it into the reality of people's day-to-day lives every once in a while. That's the way you can learn from it. If you hear a sheer fantasy horror story, you can think, I'm never going to really go to a haunted house. I'm never really going to suddenly be in another dimension. It's not going to happen. But this sort of realism horror, it could happen to you. Could happen to anyone who strays to the side of evil. And that's what makes it powerful. All right. Thanks for listening to episode 3 of our podcast. Tune in again, because as I go out the creaking door, your ghost of radio is inviting you to come back again for another episode of Mid-Century Horror Radio. And until then, everybody stay happy.